Live from Burbank, California, put on Earth 75 million years ago by Xenu, alien ruler of the Intergalactic Confederacy, it's the Mark Maron Show. And now, he's a level two, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Good evening, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. How is everybody out there? How are you people who are strung out on nicotine gum, man? I almost made it a whole day, Jim, without any nicotine in my system. And then I wondered, hey, how come it's 11:30, I've eaten four pancakes, a bag of potato chips, and a hot dog, and it's 11:30. I've been up for 2 hours. Why can't I fill this void? What is this insatiable appetite I'm experiencing? And then I realized that my wife, who went to San Francisco today to perform up there at Cobb's, if you're going to be in that area, for the she's doing a normal benefit. My wife and I, who do no drugs whatsoever, she's standing up for the cause, helping out the people that need to make marijuana legal. That's all right. Yeah, it's a cause that we can all believe in. But I realized she absconded with all the nicotine gum. So I went and got some. So I just chewed a big old fresh one, and I'm feeling all juiced up. Feel good. Feel that nicotine coursing through my system. Got my heart rate going up a little bit. It's nice to be on drugs sometimes when you don't do anything else. Am I right? Thank you, Jim, for the support.
You just chewed a big old fresh one?
A fresh piece of nicotine gum that I put it right here on the table. See, that's the color of nicotine gum always. And it's interesting about nicotine gum, if I could talk about the issues.
Sure, go ahead.
Let me tell you who's on the show first, and I'll get to that. Marcos Mulitzas Zuniga. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And Jerome, you know him from the Daily Cause. Marcos, he's the guy who created the Daily Cause. And Jerome Armstrong, who created, what's his website's name? I know, mydd.com, mydd.com, both the political websites, will be here to talk about their new book, Crashing the Gates, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People Power Politics. That's going to be a good conversation. These guys are young guys, they're smart guys, and they seem to think that they can make the Democratic Party function again. We also have Deepa Mehta, the director of the film Water, will be here. Beautiful, powerful movie that I saw the other night. Can't say enough about it. Thought it was great, and really raises the awareness of things that people in the West could know nothing about unless they're, you know, people who understand the dynamics, traditional dynamics of India. Comedian Doug Benson from the Marijuana Logs, who is also doing a normal benefit tonight here in L.A. Normal's going in for the big cash cow tonight, getting all the comics to make the stoned funny. Yeah, you're known to smoke a little herb, aren't you there, Jim?
Very rarely.
But you enjoy it, right?
I don't know. Only in Holland, because I don't get paranoid in Holland. I get anxious here when I smoke it.
So you got to go to Holland to get high?
Evidently.
Oh, that's interesting. And considering, you're saving up to get stoned, I guess, huh?
Yeah, and see a little art, you know?
Sure, I haven't been to Holland in a long time. That's a whole other story. But here's what I was going to say about the nicotine gum. It's this weird yellowish color. And when you're an addict of anything, the weird thing I notice about my wife and I is you'll see these, you know, half-chewed nicotine gums around the house because it's a drug mentality. You don't want to throw it away. So you sort of take it out of your mouth, you put it like, I'm not going to, that's drugs. That's not just gum. That's got the stuff in it. So I'm going to leave that right here next to the cereal bowl.
Is it yellow, the same color that your fingers turn when you smoke too much?
Look at my teeth. My teeth are yellow. They're the same color from those damn cigars. I got to go to a dentist. I can't stand it. I'm a vain guy, and I got these horrendous yellow teeth, and I'm not even smoking cigars. So there were some things that happened. A lot happened in the world today, and we want to make sure that you're up to speed and informed. We want to make sure that you don't get caught off guard. So here's tonight's edition of the Mark Maron Show's Short Order News. 3 years after the U.S. toppled Saddam Hussein, only one major U.S. building project in Iraq is on schedule and within budget, the massive new American embassy compound. The Pentagon said they hope to complete the embassy just in time to frantically helicopter the last U.S. soldiers off the roof. Due to security problems, other projects, including health clinics, water treatment facilities, and electrical plants, have been scaled back or eliminated, Jim. On the bright side, American construction workers in the area have gotten really good at yelling, "Hey, sweet ass," in Arabic.
Oh, man.
Yeah, how do you like that?
I like that.
In what appears to be an amazing success for American medicine, newly released government figures show that the annual number of deaths in the U.S. dropped by nearly 50,000 in 2004. That's the biggest decline in 70 years. The Bush administration hailed the new figures and attributed this success to the increased lack of access to HMOs.
That's ironic.
So, yeah. So
ironically funny.
Yeah, you live a little longer because you can't get in to get help, so you go ahead and adapt, and you don't get bad help either.
There's, right.
It's got two sides. Two multi-level joke, that
That's
one.
What's the point of that whole joke?
Man,
you
it goes...
Stick it to the HMOs, man.
Right, but it makes you think.
Stick it to the HMOs.
Yeah, I know you got a tale. I know you got a story. I know you were there today.
Kaiser.
That bastards. My dad won't work at him. This is one of the reasons my dad is no longer practicing medicine. But that's not a joke.
That and that whole lab mix-up
hey,
thing.
Hey, 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 don't talk. You don't gotta tell me. Anyways, Nottingham, the English city famous for the legendary outlaw Robin Hood, has been named as Britain's most burglar. Man, I just should do the whole thing again.
Burgled?
No, it's burglar. I can't say the word. It's like Bush and nuclear.
Burglary.
Nottingham, the English city famous for the legendary outlaw Robin Hood, has been named as Britain's most burglary-prone city by a leading insurer. Though crime-ridden, Nottingham is noted for its meticulously restored Victorian neighborhoods occupied by swashbuckling merry men. We don't have to talk about that too much.
Castro Street reference, kind of.
I know. I wasn't going to go there. I thought I'd just leave it so we don't sound like we're being...
I know. But it's fun to take apart jokes, isn't it?
No, it's not. Well, not when they're thinly veiled, bordering on, you know, wrong. That's the short order news for today. Do I have to repeat that for the music to go away? Yeah, I just was wondering when the music was going to go away. Well, you know what? Bruce Cherry's in town.
Oh, man.
He's going to come in and pitch us a character.
The Cherry.
The Cherry is in town for a pitch of the week, which is something we used to do on the old show. What was I going to say? You went to the HMO today and you had a problem with it.
Oh, man. It's like an hour and a half, 2 hours of waiting for seeing a doctor in maybe 3 minutes.
I've got a little insight into that, though. I think that happens no matter where you go to the doctor, you're going to have to wait. And I can tell you by having a doctor in the house growing up that the reason you're waiting is because he's at home having dinner and the phone is ringing. And it's his secretary saying, you have patients here. And he's at home going, hold on, my show's not over yet. That's what they're doing when you're waiting. And I'm not saying that's bad. It is bad, kind of, though.
You know, I've been to doctors before. You don't have to wait that long, though. The more money you have, the less you have to wait.
I don't think that's necessarily true. I've been to doctors, private practice doctors, and they will sit there. They will make you wait. Sometimes no reason at all. They could be having coffee or maybe taking a phone call, having sex with their secretary. There's a number of things they could be doing other than seeing you and listening to you whine about your diabetes.
Yeah, but how long do they stay with you, though, once you see them, you know?
Well, it's really a matter of performance. It's focus, bedside manner. You know, some guys, they don't make you feel that great about being sick. Other guys, you feel like you're in perfectly good hands. The problem with doctors is they get kind of jaded, Jim. They see people every day. You know,
with HMOs, they have to keep a quota per day, you know, and they get you in and out fast so they can get their pay.
What's even worse about HMOs than that, and one of the reasons why my father no longer practices medicine, aside from the fact that he's a little nutty, is that HMOs limit doctors' ability to do their jobs properly by setting not just quotas, but they have, it's almost like a triage sort of situation, is that they will only allow doctors to do a certain number of tests. They will only allow doctors to treat someone to a certain degree. And if that degree goes beyond what their bottom line works in, even if it's deadly, they won't do it. They will not enable the doctor to
do it.
Absolutely.
And who makes those decisions? People sitting behind desks.
No,
clerks.
I'll tell you who. Insurance companies.
Yeah.
The biggest scam is that insurance companies now dictate the health organization.
And they're
of this
not
country.
Qualified to talk about, you know, think about your health. They are not qualified at all.
No, are you kidding? Of course they're not qualified. All they do is sit and wonder, like, well, this many people die of that, and I think we can eat that cost. It's literally like cars being put on the market that are dangerous, that explode. If it's going to cost them too much to recall the car, they're going to go ahead and put it out there and eat the lawsuits because they don't care about people. Having insurance companies run the healthcare profession is a crime. And the insurance lobby is one of the most powerful. Big pharmacies and insurance lobbies, the most powerful in this country. And neither one of them really care about the health human beings.
Remember that thing I had a while ago, the second face on the back of my head?
Yeah.
Still there.
Well, I think that's one of the funniest parts about you. When you part your hair and you make that weird noise. Could you do it?
Okay.
Hey, Mark.
Yeah, it's so weird. It's just like that movie. It's creepy to look at. Put the hair back. Put your hair back. Put it. Okay, thanks, man. I don't know why you wouldn't use that in your act. See, if I had that.
Scares people, man.
But it's a gift. Who cares? Sometimes scary is provocative. You know, maybe people will read it as like, that's sort of like the duality of man. You know, he's got the head on the back of his in the back of his head that talks and is happy, and the other one's sort of sour and bitter, and that's sort of like the duality of man.
You think I'm sour and bitter?
I don't know. I don't know where you're coming from.
I'm bitter and sour.
All right. Well, look, I'm going to talk you. The Democrats, the Democratic National Committee, is going down to New Orleans for 2 days. That's April. That's starting tonight through the 22nd to have their big meeting. There's about 400 people going down there. They're all going to get out there and get in the street and get dirty and help out and also sort of strategize and do some business. And I think it's a great thing that Howard Dean and they have made this decision to go down to the city, because even for 2 days, to be in New Orleans for 2 days, 400 people, and put that money into that city's economy is helpful. Even for 2 days, 400 people on the street doing some volunteer work, given what that place looks like, is helpful. Granted, it is a political move, but I'm not going to – the Republicans are already saying they're grandstanding, and I say, who cares? Let me tell you something.
Yeah.
That city needs all the help it can get, and also I think it's a great symbol.
I think the Republicans should hold their next national convention in that stadium.
Which one?
In the stadium.
In the Astrodome. We're going to talk to Marcos Molitza Zuniga and Jerome Armstrong here in just a second about their book, Crashing the Gates, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics. You can go to crashingthegates.com to see if they're going to be in your neighborhood talking about the future of the Democratic Party, but they're going to be here in a moment, so stay with us.
Now he's shedding his policy-making duties. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, people. Go to markmaron.com if you want to blog. Blog with the rest of the blog people. It's no comparison to Daily Kosa. No comparison. We get like six people that blog 50 times. They've got like a million unique bloggers a day. Do you know what unique blogger means?
No.
That means not a guy going twice. A million different people,
my
friend.
What's the point of blogging if you can't go 800 times?
Well, you can go, but it's just a way of counting. Look, I was one of those people that poo-pooed blogs and internet activism initially. I thought it was a niche market, and I didn't. It didn't really facilitate any change. And I guess as time goes on, I'm the idiot, as our guest will attest. Jerome Armstrong, the founder of one of the first political blogs, MYDD.com, and Marcos Molitzas, the creator of Daily Kos, which I just said gets a million unique hits a day. They are here to talk about their new book, Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics. Welcome, fellas.
Good evening.
Thank you. Now, I want to just quote right away, because this is something I've talked about with many different people on the air, off the air. This is right from your book, a quote from your book. The Democratic Party stands for everything, it stands for nothing. It's a gaggle of special and narrow interests, often in conflict with each other, rarely working in concert to advance their common causes. Members of each issue group, environmentalists, pro-choice activists, civil libertarians, plaintiffs, attorneys, and so on, promote their agenda above all others and show literal or no understanding of the larger progressive values they share with the other groups. And so the whole is never really greater than the sum of its parts, end quote. Now, the book's agenda is to rebuild this. Where do you start with that? How do you get people that are what I'm reading here is essentially selfish on a group level and competitive to understand that they're all on the same page?
That's what it is. We have to get people to understand we are on the same page, and we have to work together as a movement. That's what the conservatives have really learned.
Well, they've worked selfishness into their policy. I mean, they are unabashedly selfish, and they are greedy, and that they're not apologetic about it. I've always thought that Democrats and progressives are somewhat sometimes similar, but they feel guilty, and they kind of mutate that guilt into charity somehow, and they don't really accept that they are selfish as well. Is there any way we can push selfishness into the platform?
Tax cuts. You know, it's one of the ironies, actually, that they are a very selfish party. Their ideology is selfish, yet they work together in concert, and they will tame their natural instincts to push for what they want and in pursuit of this greater good. Not only that, but they're always constantly evolving and constantly changing and constantly looking for new ideas. They're all crappy ideas, but they're always looking for ideas, and that actually makes them more progressive, and we end up doing the same thing over and over again.
Progressive in the sense of proactive, not progressive on the values.
As in changing. Yeah, exactly. As in constantly changing and evolving while the progressive movement ends up being conservative and that it hasn't changed the way it does business since the 1960s and 70s.
Well, I think also, don't you think that because the conservative ideology is narrow-minded and they don't really even pretend to be tolerant, that it's a lot easier for them to move forward because they don't have to accommodate all these different points of views and integrate all these different dispositions and attitudes into their ideology?
Well, that helps in a lot of ways, but actually it's not quite that way. I mean, we have a story in the book where when Newt Gingrich was doing the contract with America, they had 10 points, and Ralph Reed, who was then running the Christian Coalition, came in and demanded one of those points, and Newt Gingrich said, Ralph, you know, look, the stuff you talk about scares people, it doesn't pull very well, but you know, I'll tell you what, if we win, we'll take care of you. And Ralph Reed knew that Gingrich would take care of him and said, okay, that's cool. And then just shut his mouth, knowing that once the Republicans took over, obviously the Christian right agenda has been in the forefront of the Republican governance. So it's that ability to say, okay, we'll take care of each other. We'll put our best foot forward, and we're not going to jeopardize the movement by being too strident about our own particular beliefs.
Well, it's very interesting. In the book, you break the Republicans into groups, which I thought was pretty brilliant. You've got the corporacons, the theocons, the neocons, the paleocons, and they are seemingly easy to categorize. And by your descriptions of each group, you realize that there are really fissures within the conservative party now, within the Republican Party. And it seems that right now we can do a little bit of what they do and divide and conquer a bit, doesn't it?
We do. And what it takes from on their side, what they've done is they've gotten the organization from the evangelicals they've mobilized. They've gotten the financial backing from all the corporations. The Democrats on our side, what we have to do is activate our base in the organization. That's what we're trying to do through the internet. In terms of the finance, the campaign finance reform that's happened that has returned to dollars that the Democratic Party now relies upon small donors more than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can start to build that organization through grassroots and the financial backing of the Democratic Party, and we can, in effect, take over the Democratic Party that way.
Well, I hope you're right. I mean, I see that the Democratic National Committee is going down to New Orleans to meet, and I think that's some pretty brilliant strategizing. Who makes that kind of decision? Is that
probably
Howard Dean?
I bet he made it by himself, probably.
Really?
That sounds like a Dean thing.
You know, I mean, the Republicans are sort of accusing them of grandstanding, but the bottom line is that they're just saying that because they got nothing else. I mean, that's what politics is. It's making an example and creating a symbol, and I think it's pretty ingenious for them, because I was just down there. They need help, and even 400 people who might be running for office, who cares? They need help down there. The place is devastated, and I think it might really amplify the fact that the reason that happened was a Republican policy point.
It gets to the whole point, too, of Democrats competing everywhere. You know, Louisiana is seen on the national level as a red state, but yeah, Democrats can win there.
Oh, definitely. So let's talk about where they can win in just a second. My guests are Marcos Moulitsas and Jerome Armstrong. The book is Crashing the Gate. We'll be back with them in a second. Stay with us.
Now back to a man who's always activating his base, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
You're listening to the Mark Maron Show. You can go to markmaron.com. That's markmaron.com. There's not much to do there except talk to other people, and there's some nice people there. And Gypsy puts recipes up, so there's always something to cook. Crashing the Gate is the book, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics. Jerome Armstrong and Marcos Moulitsas are the authors. They are in the studio right now. We're talking about what the Democrats need to do. And it seems to me that there's always, you know, you always hear Democrats say, and some people get offended at even the idea of having somebody like that on our team. It's like, where's the Democratic Karl Rove? Where are the people? Where are the strategists that can really make a difference? And there are plenty of consultants. So why is it that we can't seem to make this thing work?
Well, what Karl Rove's done fantastically is figure out a way to mobilize the base all across the nation. And that's what the Democrats really haven't been able to do. The way they do it is that they provide what the Republican Party stands for in stark distinction to the Democrats. And that's how they took over the government. The Democrats, in large part, still see themselves as the natural governing party in D.C. A lot of them still haven't woken up to the fact that the Republicans have all three branches of the government now. We're the minority party. We don't set those distinctions enough to tell people, this is what Democrats stand for. If you elect us, this is what we'll enact.
And I don't understand why they can, why do we have these Democrats that run on these centricrats who are bordering on Republican, because they're trying to pander to religious fanatics in order to get votes, which makes them look spineless. I mean, why do we have to do that? It seems like the platforms that we have in terms of civil rights, reproductive freedom, in terms of environmentalism are solid. They should be attractive to people. They should be able to be made attractive to people.
I would go even broader than that and say that the values that unite us are things like fairness and opportunity and investment in the future and in people. And fact is, those are American values. But Democrats are very, very much afraid. They've been conditioned by these consultants in D.C. to not make any waves, to not make any enemies, to not offend. You cannot lead without offending people. George Bush knows this. And what it's telling is that John Kerry was the first presidential candidate in history to win the independent vote and lose the election.
Hmm. Now, that's it, but that's weird, because I know that just from progressives, not necessarily Democrats, because of what we were talking about before, because of this fear of hurting people's feelings or being not all-inclusive, they censor themselves. Whereas I think that if you get up there and say, look, this is right, this is what we stand for, if you don't like it, then there's probably something wrong with you and you might want to think about it. That means someone will walk away going, ah, screw that guy, but they'll respect you for having a spine.
First thing they got to do is go out and take a poll. That's what Democrats do. Even with Terry Schiavo.
Yeah.
Which seems like a black and white case. They had to go find out what the poll said first.
Uh-huh. What were you going to say?
Yeah. No, I mean, we're always chasing this mythical center, right?
Yeah.
So you stand for nothing if you're constantly chasing after people. I think people, if they know the values that drive your decision-making, they'll respect you. If we're talking, say, gay marriage, if the issue isn't two guys holding hands, but the issue is fairness, and you talk about fairness, and you talk about how you make decisions based on fairness and opportunity, people respect that. They may disagree with the end solution, but they say, okay, this person is well-grounded, has a core philosophy, I'll respect that. And if George Bush taught us anything in 2004, is that people can get elected even if they disagree with the candidate on almost every single issue.
And it turns out that most people, when really asked in real conversation, whether they really are concerned about, say, gay marriage or whether or not abortion should be safe and legal, they're like, you know, people should be able to do what they need to do, and they should have the right to have, you know, health care that is safe, and also have the right to live with who they want in a relationship that suits them.
Mm-hmm.
And most people believe that. It's just somehow or another these fear-mongering Republicans get these people to act beside their best interest, both economically and otherwise, out of fear.
Mm-hmm. But it's more than that, actually. I mean, that's part of it.
Uh-huh.
But the reason that Republicans can do that is because Democrats enable it. They run from these issues, so they send these signals to the voters that there is something wrong in this Democratic position on those issues. They're afraid to stand strong for those issues. So the voters think, well, Republicans are making a big deal out of it. The Democrats are running away from it. Therefore, Republicans must be right.
That's crazy. See, you know what? It's a codependent relationship, and I guess the Democrats need to go to Al-Anon and get some recovery around these issues. But I think that that personally, and not even personally, we can get the House of Representatives, can't we, in 2006?
We should have gotten it in 2002, but the exact same scenario played out with the Iraq War vote.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, the Democrats said, oh, we're not running on the Iraq War. We're going to avoid that. We want to run on Medicaid or Medicare, whatever the hell.
Right. But do you think we can get it now?
You know,
we wish.
If you look at the numbers look absolutely fantastic for us, right? We should be making humongous gains in both the Senate and the House. By the numbers, what I'm seeing, though, as I travel around the country, is that Democrats really are demoralized right now because they've lost three elections in a row, and they get their hopes up, they get crushed on election night.
Oh,
they don't want to deal with that, right?
Are you serious?
I'm serious.
Psychologically, they're just broken.
They look at D.C. and they say, well, the Democrats in D.C. haven't learned their lesson. It's not like they're doing anything differently. We don't see any leadership coming out of D.C. Therefore, how is anything going to change? And they're really starting to tune out, and I'm really scared.
There's a great indication coming pretty soon with Francine Busby's race. She got 44% in the first run, and now she's going to have a runoff on June 6th. This is in California 50th District.
Mm-hmm.
Around San Diego,
If she goes above that 44% is about what John Kerry got in the district against George Bush.
Okay.
So in that runoff, if we're going to be able to really see, like, what's the indicator here for the midterm coming up? If she's able to win that, that's going to be really great news for the Democrats.
Yeah, because that means that they've got the momentum that their big plan, it seems, as of late, was just to wait. And between corruption and lying and the war and the economy in terms of the way that they've legislated, I mean, even if Democrats win, it seems it's going to take years just to reverse the legislation that these idiots put in place in the last 4 years, in the last 8 years.
Decades. Yeah. Decades.
I mean, it's devastating, and I don't know why the hell Democratic candidates can't make regular people understand that.
Well, because they're not speaking up. The problem is you have these D.C. Democrats that are saying, you know what, we're going to keep our mouths shut, and people are going to see just how horrible the Republicans are at governing, therefore they will vote for Democrats.
Right.
And what we're seeing is that people absolutely don't trust the Republicans anymore, and nobody wants to vote for Republicans, but Democrats aren't giving people a reason to vote for them. You have somebody like Russ Feingold, who starts creating stark distinctions between, you know, saying what the president has done is wrong, look how he did it, he broke the law, we're going to hold him accountable, and you have Democrats running away from him, you know, in sheer terror.
Yeah. Is that true?
Absolutely.
Because no one really got on board with the censure resolution because they were afraid that they would be
offend somebody. Again, it's who are we going to offend?
But that is careerist politics. That is them only concerned about themselves. They're not really worried or seemingly taking the pulse of the American people.
No, you know, the Republicans, you know, talking about 2006, Karl Rove today in the Washington Post, said, you know, he's dropping all policy to focus on the 2006 elections.
Yeah.
These guys love to make history with the elections. Historically, there was no chance of them winning 2002. They won it. Historically, like Marco said, nobody's ever won the presidency without winning the independent vote. George Bush won it. They're going to go into these midterms totally focused on how do we target our base to get them out to vote.
Well, and also they've lost the independents. I mean, it seems to me that what they're doing, and I'm not really a strategist, is that by enabling, well, Bush is just sitting there committing to past lies, saying that, you know, Iraq is justified, yeah, and that it's going to go on for a while because, yeah, he's got 31% or 32% of their base that, as long as he doesn't waffle at all, will stay with them.
Yeah.
So now they've got this other, you know, chunk of base that is sitting there going, these guys are, you know, screwing everything up. So they're going to try and pander to them. I mean, some of the evangelicals are leaving them. Most of all their independent voters are leaving them. So it seems to me that if the Democrats screw this up, we're hopeless. It's over. I don't know what the hell is going to happen.
No, it does look grim, sure. But, you know, the thing about midterms is that very few people show up.
I know.
And if they're able to activate their base, then the Democrats are not.
Okay, let's go there then. So now both you guys have a very popular and famous political blogs. And my criticism of the blog world initially, and I guess it's changing, is that even if you have a million unique visitors, that's only a million people. Now, how do you really facilitate change by, you know, forwarding things or checking into a fairly wonky endeavor?
Well, the blogosphere, and I think progressive side anyway, is probably around 3 to 4 million now. Marco's blog just represents a million. And the way that you do it is that each one of those persons has to be responsible for going out and get 10 of their friends to the polls on election day.
Okay. And I can do that.
It's not just a matter of turning it on yourself. And this
right.
is Democrats will go out and vote. The hardcore activists that are on the blogs go out and vote. But to get us to be motivated to go out and work to get other people to vote.
Right, to go door to door and that stuff. Let me reset because I sometimes forget to reset. Our guests are Marcos Moulitsas and Jerome Armstrong. The book is Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics. Well, that's a big question, is that, you know, up until I got the job at Air America, I was not a very politically motivated person in the sense that I wouldn't go door to door. I wouldn't hand out signs. So in order for the web or the blogs to really work, they've got to go out. And I know during the election in 2004, a lot of people flew all over the country primarily to try to stop them from stealing the election. But I don't know how many people went out door to door actually campaigning.
Yeah, at the end of the day, nobody, I think, in the blog world is claiming that we're going to single-handedly start winning elections.
Okay.
We're a piece of the puzzle. We're a piece of a partisan liberal media, which Air America is also a piece of that, and we need to grow it further. We're a piece of mobilizing supporters, so getting them to turn off their computers, go outside and get some fresh air, and get some people to vote.
That scares some of them, you know.
Yeah, of course. We're not going to get all of them. But the idea is we got to give them a reason to get organized, a reason to get motivated, give them the talking points, get them educated about what's happening in this country and what the Republicans are doing, and to motivate them to go out and do their hard work, which we're not going to win this election on a computer. We're going to win it door to door.
Well, you also got to make them understand, just like what you said in that paragraph I read earlier, that, you know, these points are not put out there for you guys to sit at and argue about for 3 days on the blog. They're not there for you to talk to other Democrats about why you suck or why the other person sucks. At some point, you just got to get past that and say, dudes, if we don't do this, you know, we're going to be living under a theocratic rule and cars are going to to be fueled by, you know, the blood of heathens.
Well, that's how we got involved in politics. I mean, neither of us were involved in politics before the Republicans taken over, and that was our main impetus.
Yeah, it's frightening. Well, I want to thank you guys for coming, and I want to recommend that people get this book because it is inspiring, and it does have a lot of facts, and it does have it has some hope that we can actually do this.
Well, it's based on Democrats winning at the state level. This isn't theory. This is actual case studies how Democrats are winning in the state.
By being humans and talking to other humans and reaching out
and
to people.
And organizing and not being... not being single issue focused.
And not being at home going, oh, I'm going to respond to that idiot. He is so wrong.
Hey, that's all right.
I'm not saying it's bad, but they're going to have to go outside, like you said. Well, thank you so much, you guys. Jerome Armstrong, Marcos Melitzas, Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People Power Politics. You can link to it right on the blog, markmaron.com. You can also go and see if they're coming to your town. Thanks a lot, fellas.
Thank you.
Now he killed a hitchhiker in Memphis. Mark Maron!
Hey, look, man, that was back when I was still using, man. All right? That was... I apologize to that guy's family, man.
7 years, it's all right.
Come on, man. Hey, long-time listeners may remember what was perhaps the most artistically successful segment of the show, Bruce Cherry's Pitch of the Week. Each week, noted humorist Bruce Cherry would present a searing, insightful, and piercingly funny proposal for a recurring bit, complete with scripted intro. It was all done under the ruse that Bruce was some sort of addled freak. It's a testament to the man's acting ability that he pulled that part off. We've been deluged with requests to bring the bit back, so, to which I finally said, I had to say, okay, Bruce, folks, that whimsical note is just a taste of the zany antics you have in store. Please welcome back Bruce Cherry for Bruce Cherry's Pitch of the Week. Okay, so
I always wanted to cherry bomb.
Well, you know, if this bit works out, we'll go ahead and
this thing was gold.
All right, buddy. So what?
It's already worked out.
You know what?
Do you remember the mallard?
Sure.
Osama bin Mallard?
Osama bin Mallard, hilarious.
We have golden memories.
We
golden.
Do. Do we do? Those things are forever captured on
digital.
That's right, they can't. So what, okay, Bruce, so what do you got?
You want the bit? Here it is.
I do.
I'm a guy with supernatural powers.
Mm-hmm.
I know all and I see all. Mm-hmm. Mark, it's a bit that can't miss. But with the popularity of current shows like The X-Files.
Bruce, The X-Files got canceled 4 years ago.
Ew. Did I say knows all? What I meant is, this guy knows the future.
Mm-hmm.
Past can get a little bit hazy.
Okay.
I did a lot of drugs back in the 90s.
Really? I knew you then. You didn't do any drugs.
Yeah, and it scrambled my mind.
Uh-huh.
But this is a character.
Okay.
He knows what's going to happen. And his name, insert drum roll here, is Nostra Dumbass.
Oh,
kapow!
Yeah.
I'm back, baby!
Yeah.
Comedy stratosphere right off the bat!
Nostra Dumbass. I take it the name is just a placeholder, yes? Or?
Yeah, I'll come up with something.
All right.
Hey!
Yeah, what?
Now, a character that knows everything, right?
Okay.
That's been done before,
right.
I don't know. That's my point.
Yeah.
I'm not that character.
I get it. Yeah. Okay. Now, look. Now, you only know the future?
That's right.
Okay.
But not just only the future.
Uh-huh.
I only know 15 to 20 seconds into the future.
Okay.
I will demonstrate. Mark, the next words out of your mouth will be, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard of.
That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard of.
Damn, I was close. Emphasis doesn't count, does it? It's eerie.
So this Nostra Dumbass, does he write his predictions down?
Yes. And he has to write exceedingly fast.
Uh-huh.
The great Nostra Dumbass publishes his prophecies in a book of quatrains in which he describes in great detail what it's like to write a book of quatrains.
Mm.
Moments before he actually does it.
Wait.
I'm getting a message from the near beyond.
Okay.
Let me gaze into my crystal ball.
And what do you see, Nostra Dumbass?
I see myself gazing into a crystal ball.
Of course.
But with a somewhat different expression.
Mm.
I have it.
Mm.
Mark?
Yes.
In a few moments, you are going to say, I didn't sneeze, One other thing. Gesundheit.
I didn't sneeze.
As I predicted.
Oh.
Mark, to me, your life is an open book. The upcoming pages are stuck together, but it's open.
Then you know I'm about to tell you this is the dumbest idea I've ever heard. And of course, you know what I'm going to say because the whole bit is scripted.
Yes, in the stars. But if you doubt my power, Mark, let us deviate from the script and see what happens.
Let's do that. I'm all for that. Yeah.
No. Here we go.
Okay.
I predict that in a few seconds, actor Steve Buscemi will burst into the studio, place a spaghetti strainer on his head, and sing Bob Seger's Against the Wind. Wait for it.
Yeah, that didn't happen, Bruce.
Damn. Mm. But you got to admit, I went out on a limb on that one.
Yes, you did.
Note to self, stop payment on that check to Steve Buscemi. Mm-hmm. I should have picked somebody with less going on in their career.
Okay. Any final predictions, Nostra dumbass?
Yes, Mark. Mm. You are about to express an enthusiastic admiration for this bit and to announce the great Nostra dumbass as a recurring character on The Mark Maron Show.
No. In fact, it was a mistake to have this much on. I can't believe I flew you out for this.
No, you fool!
What?
You've just rent the fabric of time! Now I'm stuck forever, 20 seconds in the future! Holy crap, it's Steve Buscemi! You're late! Put this on your head and start singing now! Mark, just wait 10 more seconds. He's gonna be here.
No, sorry, time's up, buddy. Time is up, my friend. Shut his mic off. I've had it. Go back to New York. I've had it. We got Doug Benson. He's gonna come out here in a minute. He's a funny guy. I've known him for a few years. He's famous for the marijuana logs.
The pot logs.
Did you ever do that show? Were you ever in that?
No, I was never invited. You know, I was never part of that.
Oh, man, they're all your old buddies from San Francisco.
I didn't hang out with them.
You didn't hang out with the Tony Kameen?
Tony Kameen, yeah, but, you know, then he went. He started smoking pot and hanging out with a different crowd.
Oh, man, look, you know what? Russia, if I could, Russia is going to deliver air defense systems to Iran, and America couldn't do anything to stifle that. And you have the president of China, Hu Jintao, has stopped by Washington, and the president can't get him to stop buying oil from Iran. It doesn't seem like we got any friends, or the all-encompassing we. George Bush in this administration doesn't seem to have any friends in support of this, whatever they're doing with Iran, and clearly, if they do anything with Iran, China and Russia are not going to be on our team with it. It's scary stuff, Jim, and there's only one way to do that. The only one way to deal with it is to bring Doug Benson in and relieve us with some of his funny humor. Can we do that?
Light up a fatty?
Maybe you will light up a fatty in here. You know what? It's the one drug I miss. Where's my nicotine gum? Where is it? Okay. Be back in a minute.
Mark Maron Show coming back real soon. So don't go away from the radio. The Mark Maron Show coming back real soon. So don't go away from the radio. He's gonna talk about pot.
Live from Burbank, California, the irritated bowel capital of the world, it's the Mark Maron Show.
Oh, yes.
And now, eat more cabbage. Mark Maron.
I just ate some cabbage today. Do you eat cabbage, Jim? You must eat a lot of cabbage because you're one of them cabbage-eating mother.
Cabbage, celery, carrots. That's all I eat.
And you stay lean because you stay away from the cookies. But that's not even true. You're eating cookies.
No, donuts and cookies.
Oh, man.
This is scintillating dialogue.
This nicotine gum, I just went too far with it. You can go too far with any drug, and I just crossed the line.
Well, you're not supposed to inject it.
No. Yeah, how'd you? You saw me doing that over the break? Sad, because it gets all gums up the works. You know what I'm saying? No, if you chew it like regular gum, eventually you feel like your heart is surrounded by acid. So I'm going to go ahead and take it out and welcome our guest to the show. I've known this man, Doug Benson, for many years. He's consistently made me laugh. The first time I met him, I think, was at a taping of Evening at the Improv in Santa Monica. Is that possible? Yes.
Yeah, I'm sure it's possible. I don't know if I want to talk about it.
Well, we don't have to talk about it. It was so weird.
It was the late 70s.
It was. It was at least the late 70s. He's one of the creators of the long-running play, The Marijuana Logs, which is running somewhere with Chong. Tommy Chong?
He sits in with us, yes.
That must be hilarious. to be working with the seminal pot humor guy.
Right, and to be sitting there sometimes going, well, that was lame, what he just said. You know, like, did you really, you know, like, I feel that way about most of my childhood heroes now. Like, you know, they lose touch.
They do, they're still back where you left them, and you've moved on.
Yeah, but the one that still works for me is Don Rickles.
Hilarious.
That guy still kills me. Everyone else, Mel Brooks, Woody Allen.
George Carlin,
not so funny anymore.
Yeah, a little cranky. But Tommy Chong, does he ever just break into like, Dave's not here, man?
He never says that, but he does.
Oh, I would so try to get him
to say
that.
He does drop a story about something that went down with him and Cheech,
Is he bitter?
Out of nowhere. No, he's this really sweet, friendly guy.
Does he still like Cheech?
It's hard to know where they're at exactly.
But is he, like, how, like, socially retarded is he? He's like, Cheech doesn't party anymore. That kind of thing, or?
No, because Chong himself had to kind of stop partying, because they don't let you do that in prison.
Yeah.
And then probation was sticky. Like, he did a couple shows with us when he was on probation, and one of them was in Seattle.
Yeah.
And people threw pot on the stage.
Yeah.
So the Portland show got canceled. Because he was on probation.
Did he pick it up? He took it?
No. But it's at his feet, you know? Like, that's definitely a parole violation.
Oh, really?
To have weed at your feet.
Oh, really? You can't say your hands are up
standing in it.
Oh, man. Does that guy... That
I'm
happens,
just standing in it, man.
That must happen to you all over the place. Did people throw pot?
Yeah, it does happen a lot.
People used to throw panties at Tom Jones. You get reefer.
Yeah, well, imagine what they throw at the Vagina Monologues. But, you know...
Hey, folks, he'll be here all afternoon.
Just for a few more minutes.
So let's talk about that show you did tonight. Let's pretend like it's actually running live. We were going to plug a show that you were doing at UCB, a benefit for Normal, yes? Is it?
I don't think it's a benefit.
Oh.
But, you know, if you want, we can say it is.
But you're going to be there.
I don't understand what Normal does with money from their benefits.
They buy pot to throw at you at the mall.
Yeah. They just mount another benefit, I think. Like, oh, we got some cash. Let's put on another show.
And get some pot.
Yeah, well.
Let's bring some pot.
That's the crazy thing about Normal people is, no way, of course, Normal.
Mm-hmm.
They, a lot of them don't smoke pot.
Really?
Yeah.
What are they?
Which is just nuts to me. Get that excited about.
But does it make anybody go, they must be narcs or something? They're working, you know, they're moles.
No, nobody suspects anything of them because they seem like hippies, you know, because they're like former stoners or just the flower children that support.
The old guys.
Freedom and doing what you want. So, like, you know, and also fighting the man, you know, like.
Yeah.
This isn't cool.
That's so funny. That's these older baby boomers that quit smoking pot 10 years ago. They're like, we think the kids should do it, but I can't anymore because I'm retarded.
Yeah.
After 30 years of pot use, I no longer know what day it is, but I want the kids to be able to do it.
Not to mention, there's a lot of people that quit because they have just that one high that just freaks them out. Like, it's too high, and they just stop, but they still appreciate the culture and being around people that are stoners, you know?
See, that was like every high I ever had, and I thought that was the whole point of it, was to ride that out. Here we go. Here comes the paralyzing fear. I wonder if I can survive.
No, I'm, like, hoping for the one that's so bad that... It gets me out of the game entirely, but hasn't happened yet. I'm pretty good at it, as it turns out.
Yeah, you're pro?
I'm good, yeah.
Yeah. So now, I miss pot, you know, because I don't do drugs anymore. I'm one of those people that had to stop because everyone around me thought I was an ass, and I thought myself was an ass too. And I miss pot more than anything because pot's so easy and friendly and fun and makes everything good.
Yeah, I don't know why you have to cut that one out.
Because
you just go for broke. Do you drink coffee?
Oh, yeah, drink coffee.
And eat nicotine gum.
I'm on the nicotine gum. I enjoy sugar a great deal. It's very challenging to get high without drugs, Doug.
I like
very
sugar, too. Yeah, I like sugar, too, but I don't drink coffee, and I don't. I've never smoked cigarettes.
When I was smoking pot, I used to carry around a little wooden box, and I'd sort of make the pot really fine. I'd carry around my one-hitter, and I'd duck into phone booths, and it was just all day long. And, man, let's get high. The hell with this. Let's do it. I'm done. I'm throwing it out the window, man. 7 years out the window because Benson was on the show for 10 minutes.
I did radio just the other day with a woman who said that when she saw the marijuana log, she had never really tried pot, and now she's a moderate pot smoker.
You got a
convert.
Because
we made it sound so good.
A convert.
And I'm like, you're an idiot. Like, the show is, you know, constant jokes about, you know, how you forget everything and low sperm count and all that stuff, and she's on board. She's like, that sounds fantastic.
A low sperm count?
I can't have low sperm count, she said, as a woman. So
does it really make your sperm count lower?
That's what they say, but...
Does it make...
Like, that's a problem. I'd be happy to have a low sperm count.
Or does it just make some of the sperms lazy?
Yeah.
They're like, I ain't going.
Yeah.
I'm hanging out. No, sit down. Just hang out.
Too much effort to swim all the way up to the...
exactly. Can't make it.
Wherever they're going.
I am...
Namibia.
I'm trying to think, like, one time when I was... The weird thing about smoking pot, I don't know, maybe you can testify to it, maybe, I don't know, is that I found that after daily pot use, you get to that day where you don't know whether you're high anymore.
Wow. That's another day I look forward to. That would be sweet. Sometimes I wake up and I'm, like, a little high from the night before cotton mouth, but I've never been so high, wasn't sure if I was high or not.
Are you high now?
I might be. It's a distinct possibility. It is Hitler's birthday.
It is?
420.
Wow, it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is Hitler's birthday.
That's why I booked
I'm sorry. I didn't mark my calendar.
But when they called to say, will you do Mark Maron's show? I said, on 420 I will.
On Hitler's birthday?
Because, well, you know, 420, man.
Hitler's birthday. Oh, man.
Not the Hitler's birthday part. Don't dwell on that. I was just kidding around.
No, I'm not going to.
That's not why pot smokers love 420.
Yeah.
It's not because of him.
It's not?
No. Or as Tony Kameen says in the marijuana logs, something to the effect of, 420 wasn't started in reference to Hitler because, if Hitler smoked pot, he'd never make it past Belgium.
Right, right.
Not with all those delicious waffles.
So I'm trying to what the weirdest thing memory I have of you actually is, and I still think it's funny.
It's like I'm being interviewed by a stoner right now.
I know.
You jump around.
I know. It's like one time. It must have been like 10 years ago or more. Tom Rhodes and I, another comic for people who don't know Tom Rhodes, went over to Dave Rath's house out in the valley when he lived out in the valley,
right.
And there was just you and Scott Aukerman and a bunch of people there. They were jumping bikes into the swimming pool. And
we were jackass before it was cool.
Yeah, and you were mixing drinks, and I was way hungover. And for some reason, every time you turned the blender on in the other room, every time you turned on the blender, you'd go, ow, my hand! And I thought it was the funniest thing that I ever heard in my life every time you said it. And you must have said it like 7 times. That's all. That was the best set.
Yeah, I don't even remember that at all.
I know. Why would you? See, that's the joy of pot, is that you forget the good things and the bad things.
And I guess, my hand healed.
It did.
Well, once my hand wasn't...
Come on.
So once my hand stopped being a mutilated mess,
are you going?
Forgot about it.
You're going to San Francisco? My wife's up there. Can you make sure she doesn't do anything bad?
Give me a list of the no's. The don't list.
No going down on other guys.
I mean, I'll put whiteout over my name.
Yeah.
Because your wife is hot. She's also performing. We're both performing in the High Times Comedy Festival.
That's what I'm
correct?
Talking about, yeah.
At Cobb's Comedy Club in San Francisco.
So drive up, man.
Or if you're streaming in San Francisco.
Yeah, buy a bag and drive up.
On down. I think there's four shows left, Friday and Saturday.
And that place is huge. See, it's like 400 people.
Yeah, I've heard it's too big.
But not if it's packed. And Proops is going to be there. And you're going to be there.
And Tom Rhodes, the aforementioned.
Tom Rhodes is going to be there, pestering my wife. Randy Kagan.
Does he pester her?
No.
Who, Tom Rhodes? Madrigal?
Madrigal, no, he's a very sweet guy.
He's a good guy. But Tom Rhodes, he's after your wife?
No, I don't think so. My wife's tough, and my wife doesn't play that. I mean, my wife is, she's got a bigger one than me, really. I mean, she's you know what I mean? She doesn't stand for any of that nonsense. It was her birthday the other day. Are you involved with somebody
Did she
right
stand
now?
For that nonsense?
Yeah, sure she did. Of course.
Do you have cake?
Oh, yeah, we had some cake, but she can only eat the wheat-free cake. We had a very nice time. Do you have a girlfriend now?
Wheat-free?
She's got a wheat thing, allergy. Yeah. Do you have a girlfriend?
Could you feed her wheat if you get tired of the marriage and you want her out? Yeah, if you want to knock her off, do you just slip her some wheat?
If taking her out means like getting her a little nauseous, I'm nauseous. Oh, I'm leaving.
I dated a girl whose seafood would kill her, and I was like, I want to marry this woman. The plan is in place.
Who knew there were shrimp in the cookies? All right, man. So do you want to stay another segment?
I'd love to.
All right. So hang out. We're with Doug Benson, and we're going to get into some deep stuff in just a minute. So stay here, will you? All right.
Now he's ripped the fabric of time. Mark Maron.
Again? It's the cabbage.
You've gotten so fat, you ripped the fabric of time.
Wait a minute.
What?
What the hell has that got to do with anything? I was making a gas reference, a flatulence reference, and all of a sudden I'm fat?
I don't know.
Oh, geez, Jim, you know how to hurt a guy. Come on, man.
Yeah, well, look, you do a flatulence joke, and then I do a fat joke. What's the difference?
He is cleaning it up a little.
Yeah. Oh, okay, all right. That's Doug Benson is here. Do you ever go? I used to go to the gym high all the time.
He's tidying up the house.
I used to enjoy going to the gym high. I used to get high to go to the gym.
Yeah, that's good, but I lose patience with being in the gym when I'm high.
You do?
I can go on a machine for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, one of those ones where you practically tape yourself in and just set the time and go. But
what gym are you going to?
Well, you don't tape yourself in, but you know, like this thing, the listeners love it when you do this. How, you know, this machine?
The one where you move your hands back and forth Rock'em Sock'em Robots?
Yeah, while your feet are going.
Uh-huh.
It's got kind of a
quality
to it where it just forces you to exercise. It's like the laziest form of, you know.
It's like the codependent machine, the one that enables you to exercise even if you don't really want to move.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of, you know, fat guys on those things that try it for a couple of days and then
I used to like to smoke some pot and go to the gym because you get the endorphins going and you get the pot thing. So it's almost like a speedball. You know what I mean? Huh?
Yeah, it's kind of fun, but I just like, I can't, you know, like lifting weights is too boring.
Yeah.
Even when you're high.
What do you like to do when you get, like, what's a perfect thing to do when you're high?
Well, you know, everything. But
but
since you're forcing me to choose at gunpoint,
this
show,
that's the way this show works, baby.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I'd have to say Disneyland is probably the best thing.
Really?
Yeah, and amusement parks in general.
Really?
Yeah, because I love roller coasters and robots and all that crap, and when you're high, it's just...
The best.
Yeah.
It
just takes fun up a few more notches, you know?
It's also a good message for the kids, I think. A lot of kids
get high in the safety of an amusement park where you're, you know, strapped in by a
professional.
A teenager who's probably also high.
Yeah. That's so funny how, like, we get jaded as adults. It's like, it used to just be fun on its own, going on the roller coaster, but you don't want to abandon the amusement park concept altogether, so you have to sort of, you know, what do you call it? To amplify it a little bit with a little pot. Andy, you smoke a little pot? No, he's not going to talk. No, see? He's mum's the word. He's not going to admit to it.
Yeah, it's hard to get people out of the pot closet.
Yeah?
Yeah, like, we put it out there that we wanted celebrities to sit in with us in the marijuana logs, thinking that, like...
No, you got with Tommy Chong?
Well, Tommy, you know, obviously, he stepped up, but then it's a severe drop in quality from there. You know, we were hoping, like, Willie Nelson or Woody Harrelson or somebody like that.
Yeah.
And Ron Palillo. From Welcome Back, Kotter.
Did he step up?
His people expressed interest.
Horseshack?
I don't even know if he heard about it.
Is it Horseshack?
Yeah.
Or Epstein? It's Horseshack, right? Oh, that would be great.
Yeah, if we could get two other, Isaac the bartender and and the dead body of one of the landlords on Three's Company.
Roper. The other one?
They're both dead now. Roper and Furley.
That's right. Don Knotts and what was that? Norman Fell.
Mm-hmm.
Norman Fell. Come on. I know there's got to be a lot of big actors that are huge potheads because they don't do much.
Oh, I'll tell you. You want me to start naming names?
Do it!
Brad Pitt.
Really?
Pot with him.
Yeah, how was that?
I watched it happen.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I just saw True Romance last night. And
Best stoner character in any movie ever.
I think it might be his best performance ever.
Yeah.
I mean,
he really nailed it.
He did. Just the way he held it.
He must have really been smoking out of that, the honey bear.
So,
but that is a great, that's the funniest scene in a not very funny movie.
I thought, you know, I think it's a much better movie than I remember it being. So we've got about a minute and a half. Do you want to plug
something
else?
And that hotel is right down the street here. It's in Burbank, the Surf and Safari Hotel or
it
whatever.
Is?
Where James Gandolfini gets the crap beat out of him with the top of
a toilet
seat.
It was interesting seeing him as a young actor and seeing that he actually does have a lot of range.
He really does.
It's weird.
But it's over now.
He's
Archie Bunker from now on.
Archie Bunker in the form of a brutal killer.
Yeah.
So
he's that one character now.
Name some other stars. Come on.
Oh, Harrison Ford.
Yeah, like all the time, right?
Yeah, well, have you seen him on a talk show?
No.
Holy good Lord. So slow, but then what he says is pretty funny.
Yeah.
Takes forever to get the idea out, but...
Yeah, okay, Harrison Ford, Brad Pitt. Okay, I can see that. Anyone surprising, you know?
That's a good question.
Take your time, it's radio.
Yeah, I don't know.
There's no reason for pacing.
but I can't come up with a name fast enough. I'll just blurt it out when we're talking about something else.
So do you want to plug anything in these last few minutes? You're going to be at the UCB when this is already going to be on, and are we working together anytime soon?
But I perform regularly at the UCB on Tuesday nights in a show there called Comedy Death Ray.
That's right. I'm on that next week. Are you on it next week?
No, I'm not on that one. But then I also, the last Thursday of every month at 9:30, I do a show called The Benson Interruption.
Can I be on that?
Which you need to do sometime, yes.
Oh, I'd like to do that. Well, Doug Benson.
Speaking of being interrupted.
Yeah, thank you for coming.
It's
my
over.
Hand! My hand! All right, I'll talk to you soon.
Kids, don't do drugs.
Good.
Now, friends call him the Bird Lady of Hollywood, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
I saw this amazing movie the other night on Wednesday. The film Water is the third of the trilogy that includes Earth and Fire. And this movie, Water, is one of those movies that just opened a window to another world for me. It is a visually amazing film to watch. The film is set in the last days of colonial India, 1938. Gandhi is beginning to tour. Some of the old religious traditions are falling to the wayside. The film takes place in the religious exile of a widow's house and revolves around an 8-year-old widow and the horrible trials and tribulations these widows go through because of extreme religious traditions that exclude them from society. That exclusion leads to begging, prostitution, desperation. And here with us to explain and talk is director Deepa Mehta. Thank you for coming.
My pleasure.
I don't want to give people the wrong idea. It is a stunning film, a beautiful story. There's romance, there's redemption, but it's heavy, and it revolves around something that I knew nothing about. Could you explain a little bit about this tradition of what these widows have to go through in India?
There's an aspect of Hinduism
mm-hmm.
called Manu Shastras, which is an extract from our holy books, and it's about 2,000 years old. And what Manu says is... And they actually, I guess, moral indicators
mm-hmm.
and how you should behave.
Right.
Whether you're a man or a woman or your husband or wife or women who become widows. And that's when it comes to a section that I find particularly unsavory.
And these women can be, like the protagonist of the film is an 8-year-old girl. And she was, there's arranged marriages for financial reasons, and she, her husband died, and she has to have this life where she has no choices. She has to live in, it's not a prison, but it's certainly a societal exile with widows of all ages, and there's really no hope there at all.
There's no hope, and there's no choice. I mean, that's what is, I think, pretty pathetic. And the houses still exist, which is something... you know, which sends me into an absolute frenzy because the thought of 2,000 years later, after the holy books were written,
mm-hmm.
and when traditions should be questioned like this, which Gandhi was doing in the 30s,
right,
and people are doing now, you know, they're still thriving and doing extremely well.
How many are there? I think at the end of the film it said 30 million? Is that?
They said, according to the 2001 census in India, that there are about 34 million widows in India. Not all of them live in ashrams or in institutions. Ashrams are holy institutions. And basically, a widow is considered half her husband, you know, value, yes, while he's alive.
Right.
And when he dies, she becomes half his corpse. And his death has something to do with her sins.
Really?
And to atone for them, she has to live like an ascetic.
Yes.
And, you know, luckily in the last 4 or 5 years, these traditions are really being questioned, and an enormous amount of good work by women activists, in fact, is being done, and on a very grassroots level, where widows are being taught to be economically independent.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting in the film that even in 1938, there was a moment in the film when it was brought to one of the widows in the house's attention that some of the laws had already been repealed and taken off the books, but they were never told because there is a structure within these widow houses that, you know, either someone runs them, like the woman in your film, who comes off as evil, but she has her moments as well as being not an endearing character, but certainly someone who was in pain. But she was pimping out one of the widows.
That continues to happen at some degree, but there are no more child widows in ashrams today because child marriages have become totally illegal, so you don't even see that. And that's the good news.
Really illegal? Like, it doesn't happen? Like, we have, you know, polygamy is illegal here, but we have some, you know, Mormons in Utah that still do it.
You know, when you're thinking of more than 1 billion people, I'm sure there might be two or one. So,
sure. But it's,
you know, it's pretty dead. And,
uh-huh.
And also the younger widows that go into ashrams that, you know, don't necessarily have to shave off their hair, because one of the ways you have to live like an ascetic, so, and be completely desexualized, so your hair is shaven, you can only wear one piece of cloth,
mm-hmm,
one meal a day, no oil, no salt.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty grim.
Wow. I don't want people to get the wrong idea.
I know. Let's not do that.
Yeah, because,
I mean, I
think
this
you
is
know,
becoming like a... it feels like a dissertation.
I wanted to know, because for my own information, like when we walked out, my wife and I walked out of the film, mm-hmm, and there was a reporter from India who was asking people questions. And she said, what did you think of the film? And my wife's first response was like, it was beautiful. It was an amazing movie. And this woman, you know, almost looked mad at my wife for a minute. She was like, really? How did you think that was beautiful? And she said, well, the script was genius and the visuals were so stunning. But she was so affected and so much wanted the message to resonate that there were still women in trouble that she was not, you know, when I said I wanted to learn more, which is why I was asking, mm-hmm, you mm-hmm, those questions. But the story in and of itself with the 8-year-old in this film just brought so much light and so much joy to this widow's house. And it sort of changed the entire tone of these women's lives. And also you kind of move through her. I don't want to give away too much of the journey, but the sort of spirit that you captured of the country of India and of the characters in the movie were just spectacular. And the story of the woman who tries to get out and honor her love for a man and what she faces is also very touching. So it is not I don't want people to think this is a documentary or a movie that is painful to watch. It's beautiful. And I thought that the one thing I get the sense of, I've always been fascinated with India, and I know very little about it, which might be why I'm asking these questions, because mm-hmm, I'm a huge fan of Indian food. I'm fascinated with the culture, that it seemed that where you shot this film, everybody was involved in some form of ritual behavior. Is that what was going on in that time or in that town? I mean, it seemed like there was a million different rituals. People were praying. People were doing this or that. Is that the way it is there?
That's the way it is in the holy cities and towns,
mm-hmm,
of India, and there are many of them, which are on the banks of the Ganges, which is a river that we consider as Hindus holy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have the priests, you have people praying, people go there to take a dip in the holy waters first thing in the morning. So that's all becomes a part of life.
Uh-huh. And now
the way people go to Starbucks here, we go for a dip in the holy waters.
Oh, okay, so, all right. And it's just as invigorating.
It's just as invigorating.
And I read somewhere that when you got to when you first started shooting the film, this film has taken a long time to make because there is a resurgence of religious fanaticism in the city that you were basing your film in, and you
you had some resistance the first time you began shooting. Is that true?
Yes, it is true. We started shooting the film in the year 2000, and 2 days, we were there for 6 weeks, mm-hmm. and had the requisite permissions from the government of India, because you can't just go and say, if you want to go and shoot a film in India, you can't do that till you submit your script to the Ministry of Information and Broadcasting, and they go through it with a very fine tooth comb, mm-hmm. in order to absolutely ensure that there's nothing derogatory or detrimental to India or Indians. And we got the permission, they found the script fine, and after 6 weeks of intensive preparation, it's a period piece, so you know, there was a lot of work that we did. First day of shooting, a mob of about 12,000 people descended on the sets and said, and they were protesting that the film was, or the script was anti-Hindu, which was sort of interesting. I mean, I don't know how well acquainted you are with mobs. I wasn't, but
wow.
But also, I mean, you know, when have you last heard of a mob sitting down to read a script, you know?
Right.
You know, come on, let's get real here.
So 12,000 people.
Yeah, somewhat in that vicinity.
So were these religious fanatics that thought you were doing
this? They identified themselves as belonging to the RSS, which is a Hindu extremist fundamentalist group.
So these are
India.
People that probably still believe that the widows' houses need to exist.
They felt, yes, and they, you know, and this is, of course, I mean, the rise, like you said earlier, it is the rise of fundamentalism all over the world. And 5 years ago, it was when Christianity was really taking hold in the United States of America,
uh-huh.
Catholicism, Islam, where all religions were sort of being used, misinterpreted for
sure.
personal benefit.
Uh-huh.
And these guys are sort of flexing their muscles because, and coming across to the rest of India, and wanted to come across to the rest of India as the protectors of their interpretation of what Hinduism is.
Right. And it's a beautiful religion, though, isn't it?
Oh, it's an incredible religion. I mean, in my incarnation, I mean, I'm a graduate of Hindu philosophy. And, and for many years, it was one of... India was a country that gave birth to Buddhism, Sikhism, Jainism, and everybody actually lived in harmony.
Mm-hmm.
It was a secular country. And this resurgence of I think, appropriation, it's about power. I mean,
sure.
it's about socioeconomic reasons, and
yeah.
we could go into that. But
politicians exploiting people's fear.
Absolutely, because
right.
it's all... And they shut us down. I mean,
yeah. And but you, and then you ultimately went somewhere else and finished the film.
We finished the film in Sri Lanka.
And you had to recast a little bit, I guess.
I had to recast quite a bit.
Yeah.
For all the four main characters.
Where'd you find that? That 8-year-old girl was just stunning. She was just great.
I found her in Sri Lanka. I mean, we put notices in all the local schools, and she responded to them and came with her mother, her father, her uncle, her aunt.
Everybody
came for the audition, and it was marvelous. And she sat there with a little red dress and two long braids and red ribbons. And
oh, that's cute.
And I just looked at her, and I knew, and she's such bright, beautiful eyes. And
she was great.
And I just knew it was her.
But
I must tell you, because
yeah.
I started talking with her,
mm-hmm.
and 10 seconds into my monologue, I realized that she didn't understand a word of what I was saying.
Yeah.
Because she doesn't know Hindi or English.
Huh. What did she speak then?
Sinhalese.
Okay.
Which, of course, dumb me, I should have known that.
Yeah.
And I don't speak any Sinhalese. So she actually learned her lines phonetically.
Okay.
And I've never directed anybody through an interpreter and very creative hand gestures.
Well, you know, it's great. There's no way I would have ever known that. Because I wouldn't know that she was not saying the language properly, because I could
only...
No,
but I know Hindi perfectly,
yeah.
And it is, she got it down to a pat.
And the male lead, the young man, I guess some people would know if they were fans of Bollywood movies. Who is that? What's his name?
The male lead is a young man called John Abraham, who is sort of a big... has become a big mega, actually, not big, it seems... an understatement of the year, a mega Bollywood star.
Okay, well, great. You know, I really love the movie, and I really think people should see it, not only because it's beautiful, but because, like we had that conversation in the beginning, I didn't know that stuff, and I think a lot of people who are listening to the show will not have known that, and it'll encourage them to learn something and also take in something that was visually spectacular. And thank you so much for being with us, Deepa Mehta. I appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Coming up next, Mark Maron's Short Order News. Remember, do not attempt these jokes at home.
And now, did you know Scott McLellan is only 38 years old?
Oh, God.
Mark Maron.
He's 100 in hell years.
38 years old. That man looks like he's so old.
Well, you know, to have to lie that much and also deny your sexuality for that long publicly, that'll make you, that'll happen. Man, look at, I mean, $72 a barrel for oil. It's going up to like $3.75 around here. And now there's also a report that shows that Americans spend more time than ever commuting because of exurbs and whatnot, that 2.8 million people have extreme commutes. It's up to 90 minutes. And I'll tell you, man, if people, I hope they have to drive a long way to the polls to vote in midterms, and it'll remind them, you know, why these prices are like this is because we have an oil-based administration that supports price-gouging oil companies.
Steam cars, my friend.
Steam cars. Ed Schultz was talking about this guy who made electric cars.
The Gem, yeah.
Yeah. Out of Fargo. I forget the guy's name. But they only go like 25 miles an hour, and they're
Schmerd
good.
Schmerd Horgson.
No, it's not. That wasn't him. Is that a real word?
Schnerm Harnson?
Yeah, that must be him. What are you talking about?
From Fargo. He's a Norway guy.
No, that wasn't the guy's name who makes the... They only go...
Snark Snurnen?
That's him. Joey Lundvist, I think, is his name. I gotta talk about this guy who walked around a Fort Lauderdale neighborhood, this 76-year-old man, claiming to be a doctor.
Right.
He was going door-to-door saying he was offering free breast exams. You know, he's from the hospital. Door-to-door, 76-year-old guy. All right. Now... One woman let him in, let him examine her, thought it was unusual that he asked her to undress completely, and then after he left, thought maybe it wasn't right, and called the cops on him, and he was in the middle of a second examination. Now, granted, this guy is an evil guy who figured out a creative way to facilitate his need to touch boobies and molest women, but what kind of woman... Let's a guy in. Come on in. You're out there. Yeah, go ahead. I'm not blaming the victim here, but please, people, don't let people in.
It was even worse when he was selling vacuum cleaners when he was doing that.
Yeah, but at least then that's different because they're like, well, you like this vacuum cleaner? Well, what do you think of this? I mean, that was more of a seduction thing. That whole, the whole sort of idea of the traveling salesman sleeping with housewives, you know, if that really happened, at least that wasn't under the auspices can I come in and feel your boobs? I'm a professional. I mean, I know healthcare, we're in bad shape.
I fell for it once.
You did?
Yeah.
Where, did you find a lump or anything? No?
No, you know. Okay, look, you're supposed to just end right there when I say I fell for it once, because I can't elaborate on
that.
Well,
I get crazy.
And make
it
funny.
Look, let me tell you something, Jim. Hold
me to too high a standard sometimes.
I'm sorry. Then I'll just let it sit there and I'll laugh. I'm going to laugh a little more. Okay, try it again.
Okay. I fell for it once. that's more like it. See? That's,
oh, man. Oh, I bet man. You did. Oh, man. Hold on a minute. Give me a Kleenex. I'm tearing up a little bit. Is that better?
Yeah,
now I went too far with that, too.
That was
didn't
a bad week.
I went too far with that. Hey, a lot happened in the world today, and we want to make sure you're up to speed and informed. So here's tonight's edition of Mark Maron's Short Order News. In what appears to be an amazing success for American medicine, newly released government figures show that the annual number of deaths in the United States dropped by nearly 50,000 in 2004. That's the biggest decline in 70 years. The percentage of people who died of heart attacks dropped severely. Sadly, the number of people who got their faces blown off for trusting an Army recruiter had gone off the charts. See, that's kind of a heavy joke. Don't want to deconstruct it, but it's a message. You know, we know where we're coming.
I liked it.
That's not like, that's sort of like, oh, yeah. All right, Nottingham, the English city, famous for the legendary outlaw Robin Hood, has been named as Britain's most burglary-prone city by a leading insurer. In a modern twist on the classic tale, the current rash of would-be Robin Hoods takes from the middle class and sells to the fence. To the fence.
Okay. I love it.
3 years after the U.S. toppled Saddam Hussein, only one major U.S. building project in Iraq is on schedule and within budget, the massive new American embassy compound. The complex, the size of about 80 football fields, will include office buildings, apartments, a gym, a massive laser capable of blowing up an entire planet, a giant metal oxygen egg for Lord Vader to chill in, and dance revolution game in every break room, and it's called the Death Gated Community. Death Gated Community! And that's a short order news for today. Hey, that was a nice fade, Andy. A nice fade! Hey, tomorrow,
I just almost did an AutoZone. AutoZone!
AutoZone!
That's it, man. Tomorrow, Dave Poland from HotButton.com and MovieCityNews.com.
Love his water, too.
He's going to...
Get into the zone!
Right, the, David Poland is going to riff about the movie Biz, because the Fridays, casual Fridays. Also, we got, well, not so casual, Sean Willance. He's got the cover story of the new Rolling Stone coming out. The worst president in history? It's got a question mark at the bottom. I think it should just be a declarative statement. But it has a question mark at the end. And tonight I'm going to read that article so I know what to talk to Mr. Wellens about. Is he coming in or are we on the phone with him? On the phone, yeah? Lawrence Levy wrote a little book called The Film Snob's Guide. It's one of those sort of kind of funny books, but more informative, like what the film snob should know and which words to drop. And it was very helpful.
Really?
I found that I knew way too much of the stuff in there. Eddie Pepitone, our reporter on the street, on the beat, will be here with a report. And Jeff DiCarlo, this guy I'm very interested to talk to. DiCarlo is a guy, I'm not even sure it's his real name. He's a guy that did something with his taxes this year that is unique. And if he pulls it off, might make a big difference to everybody. He's sort of a tax revolutionary. Jeff DiCarlo is going to join us tomorrow.
Can you give a hint what he did?
Well, he actually started writing off things that he thought... you know, caused him stress.
Oh, that's a great idea.
You know, because it made him less of a... he'll explain it to you. So we'll see you tomorrow, Jim. I'll see you tomorrow. And sheeple, sleep tight, be careful. And don't let anyone into your house fill your boobs, even if they say they're a professional. I'm going to gym. I'm going.